Let me summarize a little bit, couple of things that we've seen yesterday. So yesterday, we took these nice equations that we had derived the day before yesterday, namely the statement that the spectrum of the spin chain, where the spins are not all up, but n of them are flipped, which means that I have n magnets. So it's n units, if you want, away from the ferromagnetic vacuum. Is given by a sum up to n of this quantity here, which was interpreted as the energy of each of the n magnets, right? So if you put zero magnets, you get just zero. That's the ferromagnetic ground state, or state, depends if lambda is positive or negative. And then these U's, the moment which are related to the moment of the magnets, are not arbitrary, of course, because the spectrum must be discrete. In fact, they are quantized through these polynomial-like equations, if you want, which tell us that uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2 to the L, which you interpret as saying the propagation of particle j as it goes around the ring, times the product of some factor, which you interpret as the scattering of particle j with everyone else, in total must be equal to 1. So it means that you take a particle, you consider the phase acquired by the wave function as the particle goes around, and the phase must be 1, must be trivial. Now, of course, when the particle goes and scatters with everyone else, a priori you would expect a mess, because it scatters with everyone else. But if there is a sort of factorization, namely that the scattering of one particle with everyone else is just a sequence of scattering processes, that would explain the origin of these equations. So the origin is really, the key thing is this factorization of the scattering, which in turn comes from the existence of more than usual local charges. So it was the fact that we had these other Hamiltonians which were local and commuted with our Hamiltonian. One implication of their existence was that we could shift wave packets by momentum-dependent amount. That means things that are going to scatter at the same point now scatter separately, and we get factorization, which implies these BT equations. Okay? Now, before I move on to the antiferromagnetic comment, I would like to make a comment related to a comment that Tibra mentioned, which is this factorization kind of pictures that we were drawing. They look like the pictures that we drew when we had this Young-Baxter relation. So I remind you that our construction was based on this R matrix. So this is called the R matrix, right? So this R matrix was a matrix that was acting on C2 times C2 going into C2 times C2, and which obeyed the Young-Baxter equation, which was this picture here equal to this picture here. Okay? Then we have another object, which is S, which would be the S matrix, which is a scattering of the magnets, which in our case is just a function, right? It is just, it's not a matrix. It is just a function S that depends on U and V, or on P and Q. It is just this function here, right? So of course, if you have this function, it also obeys that if you multiply three functions, it doesn't matter the order where you multiply. But that's kind of trivial. It is just because it's a function. So of course, function as function, it obviously is true. But imagine we had an integrable theory where particles were not just a spin down, which is something that, but was a particle which had some colors. It had some extra index, the particle. Then factorization, then the S matrix typically would be a matrix, right? And it would have to obey this equation, right? So let's consider a simple generalization of this example, where we go from the SU2 spin chain that we considered to what would be an SU3 spin chain, just to illustrate a little bit where we would have everything. So SUN to SU2 to SU3 would mean that we would just, what would change here? Here, we would have an R matrix, which would be exactly what we wrote, the same expression, except that it acts now on C3 times C3, C3 times C3. Now, instead of up and down, we have, say, 0, 1, and 2 as our basis of our Hilbert space. Do you agree? And now, the R matrix, this R matrix, obeys this equation where I multiply this equal to this, and this ensures that the Hamiltonian, and what would be the Hamiltonian? Now we don't have Pauli matrices, so in terms of, because it's SU3, it's not SU2 anymore, but in the language of permutation, we saw that Pauli matrix was the same as permutation operator. In the language of permutators, it's the same thing. It is just lambda times sum of permutation at site n and n plus 1 minus the identity. So the Hamiltonian in terms of permutation is the same thing. It permutes spins A and B, and this Hamiltonian is integrable. Okay. Now, what would be the ferromagnetic vacuum? Here, what would be before everyone up? Now, in this language, becomes everyone of one flavor. I don't care. It can be zero, for example. Right? And now, what are the excitations that move on this vacuum? Now, there are two types of excitations. Now, what was before a magnon, which I could draw just as a spin down, but it doesn't matter. I could draw it as a ball, whatever, in the vacuum, because there's only one type of magnon. Now there are two, a magnon here, as an index A, which can take value 1 or 2, because I can put a 1 or a 2, right? So I put a vacuum, and then I put here a 1, and then there can be a 2 here, and so on. Right? And now my S matrix, S here, now it's a matrix. And it's a matrix that acts now on C2 times C2 to C2 times C2. Not C3, because the vacuum is used, but the remaining two components, not C3, and I wrote C3. Right? But the remaining two components, we do have. So now it's a matrix. So this now would be some S that says I scatter magnon of type A and B, and I get magnon of type C and D. And now this as a matrix, because of the factorization, because I can shift away packets, it's not any matrix. This matrix must obey this equation as well. And now in both for the R matrix and for the S matrix, I do get an untrivial result. Okay? In fact, without any computation, I can tell right away what this matrix is. Right? Because what is this matrix? It can be only either the identity or the permutation. Right? And Young-Baxter fixes what it is. It tells that it's just this up to an overall factor that I don't know. Because we saw yesterday that when we impose Young-Baxter, we get that this function here is a linear function. So even without doing any computation, I know that if I take this spin chain, I start putting these magnons 1 and 2, 2 and 1, 2 and 2, scatter them and so on, compute using the Hamiltonian, find what the S matrix is, at the end of the day, I'll get this. Okay? The relative coefficient between identity and permutation will be this, because this is just fixed by Young-Baxter. Okay? So again, R matrix obeying this, it's a tool to find Hamiltonians. It's a mathematical tool that introduces some auxiliary space and then allows us to use these powerful techniques to find Hamiltonians. Then it implies that those Hamiltonians, the excitations there would obey Young-Baxter, which sometimes is trivial, just an identity of numbers, and sometimes it's still a little bit non-trivial, like here, where here, this is factorization. Okay, so this SU3 spin chain, I think, illustrates well the similarities and differences between this R matrix and S matrix. Any question about what we've seen so far? Okay, so now If there are no questions, what we would like to do now is to study. So what we want to do now is study the physics around the antiferromagnetic vacuum. Which means that first, for the vacuum, for the antiferromagnetic vacuum, we want to take n, the number, we want to make a state with total spin 0, so we want to take n to be L over 2. And we want to study some large spin chains, we want to take L to be very large. Okay. I remind you that the claim is that the energy per unit size is going to go to something like lambda times, I forgot factors of 2, but something like 2 log 2. Okay? So here is something that we could do just to feel more comfortable with this result. This is something we could do. We could take the Hamiltonian, so I remind you the Hamiltonian is something like lambda over 2 sum over n sigma n dot sigma n plus 1 minus the identity, right? And plug it in Mathematica, right? For some lengths L equal to 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, perhaps up to 16. More than 16 will be very hard. Okay? 16. Already this 16, the Hamiltonian will be something like bigger than this. It's 5, 6, 5, I don't know. Giffrey probably would know the power of the correct number. But for me, it's roughly this. Actually, is it? Yeah, okay, I think it's correct. And so it's already a huge, huge, huge matrix. And we could diagonalize it and compute the smallest eigenvalue when this lambda is negative, right? And plot it and see if it is approaching 2 log 2 as I divide the energy by L, right? So this is what we would do. We would go and plot this energy divided by L as function of L, put here what we think is the prediction. This would be our guess, and then we would see that indeed they look more or less like approaching this guess. Okay. The next thing that would be nice to do would be to take these equations, put here n equal L over 2, and solve them, right? Just solve these equations where n equal to L over 2 for 2, 4, 6, up to 16. Solve those bit equations, and you would get exactly the same value, and you would put some in Mathematica. But then you could go much further. If you were to solve bit equations, you could easily go up to L200, or okay, let's go to L100. Okay? And then you would see beautifully that it is indeed approaching this dashed line. Okay? So this is what you are going to do in today's tutorial. Okay. So that's the motivation for today's tutorial. But here in the lecture, we are going to find that result analytically and then study fluctuations around this vacuum. So the first thing we are going to do to solve these equations here in the limit of large n, naively it looks hard, right? I mean, you have a polynomial equation of degree that is going to infinity, a coupled set of polynomial equations. It looks like it's not the easiest thing in the world.
In what sense is it
a state
of vacuum? Isn't it out of equilibrium? I mean, isn't it an unstable point?
No. So lambda. The ferromagnetic vacuum. Okay, what I'm calling vacuum, remember, that depends on the sign of lambda, right? So if lambda is positive, I'm adding energy by putting magnets. If lambda is negative, I'm lowering energy by putting magnets. So the more magnets I put, the lower the energy. Right? So what we are now studying, starting today, we flip the sign of lambda. So now lambda is negative. So what we want to do is to put L over 2 magnets. We want to flip half of the spins. If we flip more, it's just going beyond the equator. It's like you are not studying antiferromagnetic, you are again going close to ferromagnetic, right? If you flip everyone, you went from all up to all down. So that's too much. You want to stay in the middle, right? Okay. Okay, good. So the first thing I want to do is to point out that those same equations can be written in the following form that a priori it's not going to be totally obvious, but that's the form that it's going to be very useful for us. Those equations can be written as L times twice arctangent of 2 uj minus summation over k not equal to j of 2 arctangent of uj minus uk is equal to 2 pi qj, where qj belong to integers or half integers, and this is depending on L and N. If it's integer or half integer, it depends on the value of L and N, as I will explain. Okay? So any guess on how I went from this set of N coupled polynomial equations to this set of equations here? Where I have this equation, of course, for j equal 1 up to n. So it's again a coupled set of equations, but now they look like this. So does anyone want to make a guess on what was going on? How did I go from there to here? Of course, those that don't know the answer, of course. So let me give you a hint. What's the solution to e to the x equal to e to the y? Exponential of x equal exponential of y. What's the solution to this equation? Sorry? Exactly. So it's x equal to y plus 2 pi I. In other words, what's the solution to the equation e to the I p l equal 1? It's p equal 2 pi n over l. Right? So it's useful to introduce this integer n to label the various solutions. Right? So what we did here is we took the log of this equation. You remember, if it was just e to the I p l equal 1, the way to describe the various solutions is to take the log and say that p is 2 pi n over l. That's the way you would label all solutions. We do the same here now for each equation. For each equation, we think of this one as e to the 2 pi nj times I, where this n would be an integer. And here n is an integer. It's not like there where I said it's an integer or an half integer. It is just an integer. And then I would say log of this equation, which is L times log of this, plus sum of log of this equal to 2 pi n. So it already has some ingredients. It has L times something. It has a sum and equal to 2 pi something. The only thing that it has is this arctangent rather than log of that expression. Okay? But that's easy. That is just because I like arctangent more. So if you plot log of x plus I over x minus I, or let me do I over 2. This is the plot of this function. So when x equal to 0, let me put a 1 over I here. When x equal to 0, I get log of minus 1, which will be I pi or minus I pi, depending on which sign I am. And when x goes to infinity, it decays, so it's something like this. And this function is discontinuous. Okay? This function is discontinuous. And this function, you see, it's equal to this one, which is continuous, right? And when I replace this, you see, here I'm lying by 2 pi. But because it's in the exponent, it's fine. So I have the freedom of replacing the white curve by this yellow curve. And what's the yellow curve? The yellow curve is exactly this arctangent of 2x with a 2 plus pi over 2 plus pi, because it's shifted by pi. Okay? And what we did next, we took this pi and absorb it into the nj, converting it into this qj. So you see that now it depends how many arctangents I created each time I put the pi. So if I have an odd number of arctangents, these guys would become half integers. If I have an even number of arctangents, these guys are still integers, like the n's. Okay? Because each time I add a pi, right, to this guy, it becomes an half integer, right? So 2 pi nj goes to 2 pi qj. So to absorb a pi, I'm shifting this guy by 1/2. Okay? So now it's a simple thing. You can easily see. Depend. You check how many times you use this trick, how many pi's you replace by arctangent, you count how many pi's, and that tells you if these q's are integers or half integers. Yeah? Is this clear? Okay. So now, when we do it, we have, as we said, this arctangent, which is this function here. Yeah. Or maybe this function is minus arctangent, right? Arctangent of infinity is pi over 2. Well, this is minus arctangent. So we have this function, minus arctangent, right? And this function is smooth and vanishes at the origin. And these are the two things that the previous curve did not have, these two properties. And that's why I prefer this arctangent, as you will see now. Because now I want to interpret the equations in the box. I want to think of the equation in this box. I want to think of it as some electrostatic equilibrium condition. In my mind, I will think that the first term there is some external force that is acting on my particle, and that's at some position, uj. Now I think of this guy as a position. And this is some external force. And then there are the forces, the interaction forces, between the part exerted on particle j by the other particles uk. So this is the force by the other particles, like some repulsion, like the particles repel each other. And if I put minus 2 pi qj equals 0, this would be some electric field or some constant force that I push on each particle. And the total force is equal to 0 tells me where is the equilibrium condition. So there is an external potential, external force that all particles feel. There is an interaction between the particles. And there is a constant force that each particle feels. Okay? Is it clear? Now, what are these forces there? You see that, okay, so this is the plot for minus arctangent. This is a plot for minus arctangent. So that's the plot actually for the second term there. So that's the interaction force between two particles. And that over there, the first term, is the external force. So if I would have L times arctangent, it would be just flipping this plot. And because L is big, I'll write it like this. So let's suppose first that there is no interaction force. Now I say that I have this external force that is balanced by this electric field. So I put some electric field, imagine here, right? Some constant electric field. This would be 2 pi q. And this is where the particle wants to go. This would be its equilibrium position. Right? So imagine for q1, I choose this electric field, this q. And for q2, I choose this guy. Then the particle 2 would like to go here. And so on. So depending on the q's that I choose, this will give me a guess for where these u's want to go. Right? Do you agree? Now you turn on the interaction. And what do the interaction do? The interaction, when particles are far away, they attract a little bit. So then the interaction would bring them slightly together. This would be the interaction. Now the interaction would push them a little bit, and it would bring them together. So that's the solution that we get. We choose a bunch of q's, which is a bunch of constant forces. You can think of them as the charges of your particles if you want, because you think there's a constant electric field of 2 pi, and the charge is qj, so each particle feels a different force. It wants to go to some equilibrium position, which is then corrected by the interaction with the other particles. The other particles attract them, so it shifts a little bit. Okay? Now, this picture tells us something obvious, which is that the QJs must be distinct. Because if you choose the same Q, the same electric field, the particles will go to the same position. Then, when the particles are at the same position, they exert no force on each other because the force vanishes at the origin. So they will stay at the same position. So if two Q's are the same, the corresponding U's will be the same. But you remember that is for fermions. When the two U's are the same, the wave function vanishes. So the Q's must be all be distinct if we want to ensure that the UJs are all distinct. Okay? So that's point number one. Okay? So I forgot to say something. The idea here is that a set QJ fixes a solution UJ. In the same way that when I write e to the IPL equal 1, I have many solutions, but then I say p is 2 pi n over l, each n is one solution. So n labels the various solutions. Here, the qj's label the various solutions. So the first comment we make is that the q's must be different. Okay? The second comment we make, let me make it here, is that the qj's are bounded. They cannot be whatever we want. They are bounded because, you see, can you make that qj to be 10 million there if l and n are of order 100? Of course not, because each arctangent is bounded between minus pi 2 over 2 and pi over 2. So that q cannot be whatever I want. That q is bounded. Right? That q, I have l arctangents minus n arctangents. So at most I can get L minus N times pi over 2, if the U's went to infinity. That's the best I could have. So these QJs are bounded. These QJs are bounded. Okay. And the maximum Q in absolute value you could have will be something, as we said, the maximum you can go if you send that U to infinity would be something like pi over 2. I divide something like L over 2 minus N over 4. And this means that, okay, there might be some shift by one unit or something like that, but roughly this. Okay? And that's because, as we said, that's a consequence of are tangent being bounded. Okay. Any question here? Okay. So if n equal L over 2, you see what happens if n is equal to L over 2, your maximum Q and your minimum, sorry, I did something wrong here, n over 2, sorry, typo, n over 2. If L is equal to n over 2, you get here L over 2, right? You get L over 2, no, you get L over 4. So you have to put integers between minus L over 4 and L over 4. They need to be all different, and you need to put L over 2 of them. So there's only one choice. You must use everything from minus L over 4 to L over 4. So in that case, you actually have no choice. So there is a single choice, which is to say that these QJs are equal to minus L over 4, and then there are these shifts of 1/2 that we said, sometimes it's integer, sometimes it's half integer, then minus L over 4 plus 3/2 L over 4 minus 1/2. Okay. In other words, the QJ are equal to minus L over 4 minus 1/2 plus J. Okay. So here, yeah.
We are getting all these results in the limit and going to the infinity?
No, so far we did not take any limit yet. We are going to take a limit, but there's no limit taken yet.
But shouldn't we get number of solutions equal to n L2s and L by 2s?
Exactly, good point. So it's a very good comment that was made here, which is, why did we get a single choice? Because we had one singlet, but there are many singlets, right? We have L spins 1/2, we could get many, many states. What we are seeing here is that we made a tacit assumption. We said that these U's are real numbers. If the U's are real numbers, everything I said is correct. But if the U's are complex, we need to go to the complex plane and start studying these forces in the complex plane to study the distribution of roots. It's a more complicated problem. But it turns out that those solutions have more energy than this. This is the only real solution, and it is the antiferromagnetic vacuum. One intuition about these complex solutions that I did not want to spend too much time about it, which is that you could have anticipated that there should be complex solutions to these equations. These complex solutions, they have the following meaning, which is related to these magnets. Should these magnets as particles form molecules, form bound states, or not? Suppose I have 10 magnets, and I am in the ferromagnetic vacuum. It's very natural that I would have everyone spin up, then a block of spin down, and then everyone spin up. And this block will move more or less as a train together. Why is it natural these solutions to exist? Because if you compute the energy of this configuration, it's like for the kinks of the sine Gordon that we discussed before. The energy is zero everywhere outside, it's zero inside the block, it's zero outside, so it costs very little energy, it just costs the wall of this block. So it means that the spins will want to form these states where they move together, and they don't want to separate. It's not exactly a block, but they want to move together. Now, how do you add up these plane waves, these particles, and form these blocks? It's when you go to complex solutions, right? That's what a bound state is. A bound state is when you have two particles with momenta p1 and p2, And P1 has a positive imaginary part, P2 a negative imaginary part, and then the wave function decays when they are far away from each other, and they want to be close. So these solutions, complex solutions, they represent solutions that contain domains of ferromagnetic vacuum. So they are more of ferromagnetic nature. So when I have these complex solutions, it's because I constructed a little bit of ferromagnetic vacuum here and there and so on, which correspond to these blocks. So if I want to be as far away from ferromagnetic blocks, I should consider real solutions. And real solution, there's only one, as we just showed. Okay? Now, this was fast, and if I had one extra lecture, I would spend some time describing these blocks and these complex solutions, which is beautiful stuff, but I don't. But so we ignore complex solutions, and then we see that there's only one real solution, and this is indeed the antiferromagnetic vacuum. More questions?
Since energy and spin commute with each other, shouldn't you get more solutions with the same energy?
So if I understand correctly, the question is, because the Hamiltonian commutes with SU2 symmetry, states should come in multiplets. So whenever I have a state, if I act with a symmetry generator on the state, I get another state with the same energy, right? Because the generators of SU2 commute with the Hamiltonian. So there should be a way of taking a solution of Bt equations, doing something trivial to it that doesn't change the energy of the state and yet gives back the same energy. That's indeed something that is true. So take these equations, and suppose you add an extra beta root, an extra u tilde, and you put that u tilde at infinity. If you put it at infinity, in the equations for the other u's, it doesn't matter, because the extra term that you put, you send the u to infinity, it's just an extra one. And the equation for the u tilde is also 1 times bunch of 1's equal to 1. So putting an extra root, if you put it at infinity, you can always do it and add an extra root to it. And what does it do to the energy? Plus an extra root at infinity, 1 over infinity squared plus 1 quarter is 0. So putting this extra root at infinity don't change the energy of the state. And you remember that the state was constructed by acting with many b's, so the guess would be that b at infinity would be proportional to just the lowering operator, the overall lowering operator, and indeed that's true. Okay, good. So any question now related to any other question? These are good questions, yeah. Please continue. Okay, very good. So now you see that we have many, 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 many integers, right? And we have these qj's, and we have our root uj. Right? So corresponding to each qj, we have a root uj. And of course now what will happen is that we'll have a density of roots, because there are so many, that there will be a density of roots, where here I'm plotting u, and here I'm plotting the density rho of u. Now, what's the density rho of u? Rho of u is something that when I integrate from a point u1 to a point u2, rho of u du, it counts how many roots there are. It gives the number of roots between u2 and u1, which is nothing but j2 minus j1. If u2 is associated, is the particle j2, and if u1 is associated to j1. Right? Then we have j1, j1 plus 1, j1 plus 2, j1 plus 3. So the number of the total number of roots in between u1 and u2 is j2 minus j1. Okay? So we can think, if you think like this, so let's suppose I think of this. Let me put v here, sorry. Let me put v dv. And let me think of this J2 as being J of the final endpoint, which I will call U. So this U2 I will call U. Okay. Now if you take derivative with respect to U of this equation, you get that rho of U is equal to the derivative with respect to U of the map J to U, which is the inverse of the map that for each U gives me a J. Okay? Now, here I'm using the continuum limit. I'm saying that in the continuum limit, instead of thinking that I have a discrete set, I now have a function U of J that varies now smoothly as I change J from this minus L over 4 to L over 4. And correspondingly, there is an inverse J of U. Okay? Okay, good. So if that's the case, so is this step clear? This step some people find a little bit confusing. So please tell me if this is clear.
J is some kind of a current, or?
No. J was just the index. Tell me, J runs from 1 to L over 2. So if this is the first root, this will be 1. This will be the root L over 3. Could be one of the various roots. And there is a map that J equals 1 goes to U1, J equals 2 goes to U2, J equals 3 goes to U3, and so on. So there is a function U of J and correspondingly a function J of U. Okay? Okay. Sometimes people write this as 1 over the separation U J plus 1 minus U J. It's the inverse of the separation of the roots. If the roots are very, very tight together, the density is very big. If the roots are well separated, the density is big. And with this definition, indeed, you get that when you consider these roots. Okay? This definition is equivalent to a more standard definition where I sum over delta functions, delta of U minus UJ, if you prefer. Right? Because it's defined through this relation here. Good. So if this is clear, let's go and take derivative with respect to U of that equation. So we take derivative with respect to U of the equation in the box. And what do we get? Let me actually start by the right-hand side. The right-hand side, we have Q, which is this. So on the right-hand side, we get 2 pi times derivative with respect to U of that, which is rho. Do you agree? That's from the right-hand side. From the left-hand side, I just take derivative with respect to U. Derivative of the first time, of the first term, gives me L divided by U squared plus 1/4. Okay. And derivative of the second term gives me minus summation, which I can replace by integration because I'm in the continuum limit, rho of V dV times 1 over U minus V squared plus 1. And this density goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. So you might be a bit surprised that I knew how to take derivatives of arctangents so fast. Yeah, if you are surprised. It's impressive, no? But the reason is that, of course, I know that arctangent is log of this. So all I did was derivative of this, which is 1 over u minus I, derivative of this, 1 over u plus I, and I put both together and you get the Lorentzian. So once you remember where it came from, it's rather obvious why this is true. That's why I'm pretty confident that I got things more or less right. Even though here there is a factor of. Okay. Any question here? So this is an integral equation that we got here for this density characterizing the antiferromagnetic vacuum. So we got this nice equation here that we have to solve now. Okay. So again, this equation is the continuum limit of the so-called beta equations, where instead of now having these uj's, we trade it by some density rho of u. Instead of individual u's, we now have a density of u's. Right? So if we solve this equation, what would be the energy? Suppose I solve this equation, I get rho. What would be the energy? The energy would be that sum, which is given by? So you have many, many, many u's distributed according to some density. How would you write that sum? Sorry? Exactly. So it would be lambda times the integral rho of v dv divided by v squared plus 1/4. Right? So we should solve the integral equation and then plug it onto this expression for the energy. So, and the claim is that if we do it, we will get that 2 log 2. Okay, but just so that you see where we are going. Okay, any question here? Okay, so how do we solve this equation? How do we solve integral equations of this form? Anyone? So let's see. What do we have here? Rho, this is easy. Lorentzian, that's easy. And what do we have here? We have an integral. What would you, how would you describe this integral? There is u minus v, and there is v here. What are we doing here? What's this operation of integrating something of u minus v times something of v? Convolution. This is a convolution. So we have rho equal convolution of rho with something equal to something else. So what do you do when you have convolutions and want to get rid of convolutions? Fourier transform. So what we are going to do is Fourier transform this equation. Right? So we multiply this box. Let's do it. So we multiply this box by e to the I omega u, and we integrate over u. Okay, so what do we get? Again, let's start by the right-hand side as usual. The right-hand side gives me 2 pi rho hat of omega, Fourier transform of rho of omega. Okay. What about the first term in the left-hand side? What is the Fourier transform integral du L over u squared plus 1/4 e to the I omega u? You see that you want to pick the pole at u equal plus minus I over 2. Which one do you pick? It depends on the sign of omega. If omega is positive, you want to close up. If omega is negative, you want to close down. Right? Whatever you do, after you close, what you get here, you plug u equal to I over 2. So you get e to the minus omega over 2, where omega is the absolute value of omega. right? So what you get is L e to the minus absolute value of omega over 2. This part is easy. And now let's just work out the residue. The residue get u minus I over 2 times u plus I over 2. If I pick the u minus I over 2, I get I over 2 plus I over 2, which is I. I multiply by 2 pi I, so I get times 2 pi. Okay, was this clear? I close up or down depending on the sign of omega. So here, the first term is 2 pi L e to the minus absolute value of omega over 2. What about the second term there, this the convolution? Fourier of convolution. How do you, what is the Fourier of a convolution? Sorry? The product. So the product of the Fouriers, so minus rho hat of omega times the Fourier of that, which is exactly the same as here. It's a Lorentzian again, but with 1 instead of 1/2. So we get times 2 pi e to the minus absolute value of omega. Okay? So we conclude that rho hat of omega is, I cancel the 2 pi's, I divide everything by this, I multiply by that, so I get L over twice hyperbolic cosine of omega over 2. Right? So that's rho. I removed the absolute value because cosh is even, so now it doesn't matter if it's positive or negative. Now this is rho hat of omega. What is rho of theta? Of u, sorry. What is now the Fourier transform of 1 over cosh? Someone know what the Fourier transform of 1 over cosh? No?
Is it 1 over cosh?
It's 1 over cosh, yeah. Almost no one knows that there's more than the Gaussian that have the same, that are invariant under Fourier transform. So the Fourier transform would give L over 2 cosh of pi u. So this function L over 2 cosh is the density of roots in beta root space. So it goes to 0 at infinity, and this is our density of roots. So the integral inside, the area here inside, is L over 2. Huh? Which is what? Which is the Fourier transform at omega equal to 0. I put omega equal to 0, I get L over 2 indeed. Huh? Any question? Just now you take this row. Row is this. And you plug it into this expression. And you get 2 log 2 times L times lambda. So it's perfect. Now, and this is the antiferromagnetic vacuum. You see, it's an untrivial state. It contains many, many magnets. There is an untrivial distribution of magnets. That's what it is. Just to conclude something that will be relevant for the tutorial, you see that if you would like to test all this, here is something nice that we could do. We could say here in the middle, there is some root u equal to 0, right? And suppose I want to guess, to have some estimate of where the other roots are. Right? So what do I do? I do integral of rho of v dv from 0 to some v that I want to estimate, to some v star, it's equal to counting how many roots there are. So it's equal to some integer n star. And now I have the precise density, I can compute this precise integral, and this gives us a guess, an estimate for these roots, v, and it tells us that a good starting point for these v's is the following. V should be approximately equal, or let me write different, the uj's, these roots, the beta roots, uj, should be approximately equal to 2 over pi arc hyperbolic tangent of tangent of qj times pi over L. Okay? So this is just to say that for each integer in the list that we have here, for each integer in this list, you now have a guess for where more or less the beta root is. That's a guess. It's not exact because L needs to be infinity. If L is 10 or 20, it is just a rough guess. But it should be a good guess. So this gives you an idea of where should you start looking if you want to help the computer. Okay? So now, if we were to solve numerically in the tutorial, when you are going to solve using Bittensatz to find these points, right, we use that starting point to find these solutions, which are exact solution. Exact solution. There's no approximation. Any L exact, but to say start looking close to here. This should be roughly correct. Right? And the computer starts looking, moves a little bit, finds a nearby solution. And then that nearby solution, you will then compute many L's and see that, of course, it approaches this 2 log 2. Okay. Questions? Okay. So I would like, how much time do I have? No. It started much later, like half an hour later because of this changing rooms. No. Okay. So this is the antiferromagnetic vacuum. It gives us a number. Now, I would like to describe what happens when we go a little bit beyond the ferromagnetic vacuum and we start seeing the spinons. Right? So now I want excitations around the ferromagnetic vacuum. So what do we want to do? We want to now, next, consider the state where instead of n over L over 2, we want to say that we do L over 2 minus 1. So we don't go all the way to the antiferromagnetic, we stay one unit before. Okay? Then you see that the maximum value that these q's can take, you can estimate by sending the roots to infinity. So when you send them to infinity, L goes up, gives L times pi over 2, but then there is this minus, so n fights against it. So by decreasing n, we have a little bit more space. Okay? By increasing n, by decreasing n, we increased our L max. Okay? So now our L max, 1 second. Okay, let me do it. So give me a second. So by increasing n by 1, you see, it was basically this equation that I wrote here. Right? So if n is smaller, we have a little bit more space here. Okay. So it turns out that in that case, okay, I'll try and then we'll see if it's correct or not, but I'll try. So I think it's the following. So we remove this. We remove this. So now this would be one and so on. Okay. So now we have, instead of L over two choices, we now have L over 2 plus 1 choices. We have values that it can take. Now, instead of an equal, I should say the q's belong to this set, because now I have some choices. Okay? So you see what is happening. We have L over 2 minus 1 q's to put in a lattice of L over 2 plus 1 options. So you see we get one less mode number to choose because we have one less excitation and one more option to put, right? So basically what happens is that out of these choices, if we put them in a grid here, we have to choose almost everyone, but there are two guys that we don't choose, say this one and this one. This would be the cues that are not used. Out of this list, I have to take distinct cues, and I take them all except two. Right? Okay, let's continue doing this small surgery. I hate when people do what I'm doing now, but in the interest of time, I'll go on doing it. But I suggest that you copy after the class is done such that you don't have to suffer writing everything again. So what are the cues now? The cues now, they start earlier, but they jump here and they jump here. So at some point there is a jump, so a theta every side, a step function that jumps at position J1. And later, it jumps at some other position, let me call it J2. Okay. And I have to choose, I can choose this J1 and this J2. The various choices are the various states I could choose. Okay? Everything else that I said is correct. Everything we said before is correct. So now what's the modification that we need to do when we take the derivative of the equations? This is exactly the same. The difference is here. The derivative of the derivative now, it's not just rho, right? It's not just rho, but when I take a derivative with respect to u of this equation, I get a derivative of a step function, which is a delta function, and a derivative of a step function here, which is another delta function. Right? So I get almost the same thing, except that I get here, plus let me get the signs right. 2 pi times delta of u minus u1 plus 2 pi times delta of u minus u2. Where what is this u1 and u2? I have all my bitter roots. I have, actually, I should not call, I should put some bar maybe, U bar and U bar, right? I have all my bitter roots, U1, U2, U3, and so on. So I can plot Uj as function of j, and I order them, so I get something like, as I change j's, I get a bunch of u's. And at position j1 and at position j2, I don't have a u, so instead what I have, I call it u bar. U bar 1, and here u bar 2. Whereas if I am at another integer value, I get one of the other u's. So I have many, many, many u's, and the missing ones, which are called holes in the language of condensed matter, are what I call this u bar 1 and u bar 2. Okay. Is it clear? So this is what we get here. So it means that now, when we solve this equation, right? When I solve this equation, I have, when I Fourier transform it, plus 2 pi e to the omega, the Fourier transform of a delta function is e to the I omega u1 bar, plus 2 pi e to the I omega u2 bar. So the equation is linear, so I already solved it for this white, for this source, and now for this extra source, I solve, and I get plus 2 pi, which gives me e to the I omega u1 bar divided by 2 cos omega over 2 plus the same thing for u2 bar. So that's the perturbations. It's much smaller than the previous term. Sorry? It's the Fourier transform. Right? Okay. So now the next step, I cannot recycle things that I've done before. The next step is a little bit new. The last step is trying to make this picture here a little bit more precise. Let's try to define this u1 bar and u2 bar a little bit more precisely. By doing the following, let's take the equation in the box. Let's take the box and define 2 pi times a function q of u. You see, it's almost the left-hand side of the box, which is defined as L times 2 arctangent of 2u minus sum over k of 2 arctangent of u minus uk. So this function has the following property. Q, when I evaluate it at some solution to beat equation uj, I get the integer qj by definition, right? So this function q is a function, if I plot it function q as function of u, and here I start with u1 and here I go up to un, at u1 the function gives me q1, at un it gives me qn, and then it's a function that goes from here, and whenever I pass by a root uj, it gives me the corresponding qj. Right? But then there are two roots that we said that are not used, the one corresponding to this J1 and the one corresponding to this J2. Those are the Qs that are not used. But this function is still defined. So this defines me my U2 bar, and this defines me my U1 bar. Okay? That's what these U's are. Okay? Now I'm going to do a jump because I think I feel like this is becoming a little bit too technical to carry on. But let me notice that now this function, I can compute it exactly because I replace this, I can compute it in this approximation. I replace this by an integral, rho of v, arctangent of u minus v. For rho, I plug the solution, right? And then finally, to find the position of u1 bar and u2 bar, I impose that when I plug into this right-hand side u1 bar, I should get the integer that I did not choose. And when I plug u2 bar, I should get the other integer that I did not choose. And this gives me two equations for u1 bar and for u2 bar. Then I take those solutions, I plug it into the energy, and you see that the energy will give me the antiferromagnetic state plus some function of u1 bar plus some function of u2 bar. That's trivial. That's just from this. Right? So is it clear? So now I'll write what the final formulas, what the final result is with all factors of 2 and so on. For what these equations are, okay? So at the end of the day, we get some equations for these two parameters, u1 bar and u2 bar. And these equations take the following form. The energy is given by the energy of the antiferromagnetic state. Okay. Minus lambda sum from J equals 1 up to 2 epsilon of U bar J, where epsilon of U bar is equal to pi over 2 cosh of pi U bar. So that's the energy of the two guys, one at U bar 1, one at U bar 2. Okay, it gives this. That's the easy part, where this equation for the u bars that I get, again, by evaluating this equation at u1 bar and imposing it's an integer that I missed, and evaluating this equation at u2 bar and imposing that it's an integer that I missed, what I get is e to the I p of u bar 1 times l times S of U bar 1, U bar 2 equal to 1, and E to the I P of U bar 2 times L times S of U bar 2, U bar 1 equal to 1. So these are the equations I get. It's equal to an integer. Then I exponentiate so that I get these beautiful equations, where now the interpretation of this equation is clear. I have two excitations, U1 and U2, that are interacting with each other, where P of U is equal, I hope I have it here, yeah, P of U is it's arc tangent of sinh of pi U. That's what the function p of u bar is. Okay. And, by the way, so if you combine this equation and this equation, you could think that this u bar parameterization is very silly, because these two equations are a way of, if I solve for u bar from the second equation and plug it here, they give me just epsilon of p equal pi times cosine of p. So it looks a bit silly to use this u bar if in the end it is just a parametric representation of cosine of p. Right? Why not just use here cosine of p and here p? Right? But the point is that the S matrix is nice in these variables only, where the S matrix, which is only a function, actually, of the difference of the two. Sorry. So S of the difference of the two guys is equal to minus gamma function of I u over 2 times gamma function of 1/2 minus I u over 2 divided by the complex conjugate, gamma of minus I u bar over 2 gamma of 1/2 plus I over 2 times u bar. Okay? So this is the S matrix for my spinons. And this is the energy of a spinon. So you see that even though it was a single spin flip, because of this crucial thing, that even though it was a single spin flip, it gave rise to one less choice and one more option. So we have two choices to make for who to leave empty. So we have one spin flip, but we have to choose 2 degrees of freedom of where to leave empty. So mathematically, this is where this fractionalization took place, where suddenly we had these two choices to make, this J1 and J2. Now here we see the physics of what's going on. We see that the final equation are really saying that I have a magnon 2 that goes around the ring, scatters with magnon 1, and the total phase is 1. And here I see a particle with momentum 1 scattering with particle 2, and the total phase is 1. Right? So the interpretation is clear. These are describing two particles with momentum p1 and p2. This is their scattering. This is their quantization equations. I solve these equations, I plug here, and I get the antiferromagnetic vacuum. Right? Now that you know this S matrix, you can really write the equations for any number of spinons, just multiplying many S matrices. And instead of using those equations, you can now just use this one where you replace these two. Now, if you wanted to study many spinons, you would replace these two by the number of spinons. And you would replace this S matrix by the product of the S matrix of uj with uk for any number of spinons.
Is it possible to have one spinon?
Now, in this case, it was not possible to have one spinon because each spinon carries spin 1/2, and because the fundamental move has spin 1. Now, you could have one spinon if instead of using L even, which is what's implicit here, because I'm saying that n is half of L, if I have L odd. Because if I have L odd, I cannot get a state with spin 0. I can get a state with spin 1/2 at most. Right? I can only cancel everything up to 1/2. So then the vacuum itself is already a spinon at rest. And then the excited state is giving velocity to this spinon. So if I fix L to be even or odd, I only have an even or odd number of spinons in my system. Okay? But now we could ask, is there a quantum field theory of spinons where they interact and so on, where they have this dispersion relation and, right, where they have this dispersion relation, this S matrix, and I could imagine constructing this theory. Okay? So
this theory will have a Zeki symmetry? Is that correct? This quantum field theory?
No. Not that I know.
If the excitations even at all.
I don't know of a simple reason why they should be. I mean, here it's spin conservation. It's just the fact that the total spin is even or odd.
But in the quantum field theory, you'll have this number of excitations. The parity conservation.
Yeah.
So you'll have a Zeki symmetry.
Perhaps there is some kind of Zeki symmetry. Okay, so let me just say a few concluding words. I'm not sure if I'm giving two more lectures or one more lecture or not. I emailed Kevin asking for one or two more lectures, but he didn't reply yet, so...
Henry, you get 7 lectures in total, right?
Was it 7 or 4? I thought it...
Didn't Kevin at some point say that he has to be away, and he would rather have you get half the lectures?
Ah, perhaps. Yeah, maybe before complaining, I should read the mail. Yeah. So
we actually have 3 more lectures.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Well,
wow.
That was my understanding. That initially, it was you 1 week and Kevin 2 weeks, and Kevin said, well, I'm going away and they would like to be there longer, so why don't we do it now?
Perfect. Beautiful. Okay. So this concludes question one of this list of 3 questions that we made in day one. I'll smoothly go to question 2 and 3 in the beginning of next week. Okay. Have a good tutorial.